From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Relax, I don't bite. I guess you're handsome in a Texas hick white trash dumb kind of way.
Today, Jared Leto talks about playing a transgender woman with AIDS in the new film Dallas Buyers Club. Leto stayed in character while on set and lost a lot of weight for the role.
I remember there was a time where I was washing my makeup off. It's like, man, they did a great job. I'm looking real sick. And then I wash it again and I realized that it wasn't the makeup anymore. It was just my face.
Leto got his start playing Jordan Catalano on My So-Called Life. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews an album he calls modestly amazing from country singer-songwriter Brandi Clark. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel she says is truly deserving of the adjective Dickensian, Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jared Leto, co-stars in the new film Dallas Buyers Club, which is based on the story of Ron Woodruff, a rodeo cowboy and electrician who was diagnosed with AIDS in 1985 and told he didn't have long to live. Not having access to possibly life-prolonging drugs because they were still in the trial phase, he sought alternative treatments in Mexico, smuggled those drugs into the U.S., and formed a buyer's club for fellow HIV patients. He had been very homophobic, but being exposed to a lot of gay people in the club changed his perspective. Woodruff is played by Matthew McConaughey. Leto plays a transgender woman with AIDS and a drug habit who works closely with McConaughey in the Buyers Club and becomes a good friend. Leto first became known for his role as Jordan Catalano in the TV series My So-Called Life. He played a junkie in the film Requiem for a Dream. In The Panic Room, he was one of the burglars who breaks into Jodie Foster's home and terrorizes her and her daughter. Leto played John Lennon's assassin, Mark David Chapman, in the film Chapter 27. He took time away from acting to focus on his band 30 Seconds to Mars. The Dallas Buyers Club is his first film in several years. Let's start with a scene from it. His character, Rayon, is participating in a clinical trial for the AIDS drug AZT. She's in the hospital for a checkup with her doctor, Eve Sachs, played by Jennifer Garner. Rayon is wearing a dress that reveals how gaunt she's become. She has a scarf around her head and long pink fingernails. She speaks first.
Do you like this dress? Because I think the neckline's a little plunging.
Rayon, the whole purpose of this study is to determine if AZT is helping people.
Come on, Evie, you know there ain't no helping me.
That doesn't mean I'm going to stop trying.
Why are you so good to me? Bless your little heart.
Just promise me you'll show up for the rest of the trial.
I promise you that I will try my very best.
I want you to mean it.
Jared Leto, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the new film. This is your first movie in 5 years. You've been touring with your band, but what was it about this movie that brought you back?
Well, I was seduced by this beautiful creature, Rayon, and a wonderful script and, you know, the potential and possibility to be a part of something that was really special.
Had you been rejecting scripts in the past 5 years?
No, just been rejected. That was a joke, but I was...
Thanks, because I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes you guys are so serious over here. You know, there's a lot, there's a big world out there, and I was exploring other things. I hadn't made a film in 5 or 6 years. I'm in a band called 30 Seconds to Mars, and we were touring the world and having more success than we ever dreamed, and it was incredible. You know, there's another part of it as well. These little films, they can break your heart, and I tend to make smaller films, independent films, and you know, it's a risky business, so you have to be very careful about what you do. But when I read this script, I thought this was a worthy experiment, and I was really, really excited to work with this incredibly gifted group of people.
When you say little films can break your heart, do you mean you pour your soul into it and then sometimes nobody sees it?
Yeah, and it's not even about people seeing it. Sometimes they just don't work. They don't come together, and of course they don't have the support or they don't find an audience. It's a beautiful thing to work with people that are willing to risk it all, and I felt that way a few times in my career, and certainly felt that way on Dallas Buyers Club.
So you say the character of Rayon seduced you, and she's a very seductive character. I mean, she basically seduces everybody she meets, not sexually, but just it's that kind of flirtatious personality. Describe what you did to become the character.
Well, the first thing that I did is I had a Skype meeting with the director. I was in Berlin playing a show, and it was the winter time. And I remember this because, you know, it gets dark very early, and, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was very cold. But we set up a Skype, we said hello, we connected, and then I reached out and I grabbed some lipstick and I started to put it on, and then I unbuttoned my thick black wool pea coat, and I had a little pink furry sweater on, and I pulled it down over my shoulder, and I proceeded to flirt with him for the next 20 minutes, then woke up the next day with the official offer. So that was the very beginning for me, as Rayon would. Girls gotta do what a girl's gotta do. But the beginning for me as far as working on the role was listening, meeting with transgendered people and listening. You know, I met with people that were incredibly open and kind, very generous, and shared their stories with me, stories of challenge and perseverance, stories of transition.
What were some of the most helpful things you were told by transgender people you talked with?
Well, what it was like to tell their parents who they really are, what it was like to...
Which you have to do in the movie with your father.
Yeah, so that kind of thing was key. You know, talking about the difference between a drag queen or transvestite and a transgendered person. And I always saw Rayon as someone who wanted to live their life as a woman, not just someone who enjoyed putting on women's clothing, and that's a pretty big distinction to make.
When you were wearing the clothes Rayon wears, which, why don't you describe one of her outfits and tell us what felt like you, as a man who is not transgendered, to be wearing them?
Well, talking about the wardrobe, what really comes to mind is the scene with my father and the bank.
You're wearing a kind of oversized suit.
Yeah.
It looks like it must be old, and you've lost a lot of weight since then because you have AIDS.
Yeah. It was actually Ron's suit that I had borrowed. That was kind of the backstory. You know, the closest person to me that would have a suit that I could hijack for the day. But I go to the bank.
So the Matthew McConaughey character. Yeah.
Yeah, for Matt's character. But I go to the bank, and basically it's to say goodbye to my father. I'm dying of AIDS, and to tell him that I forgive him. You know, he's a guy that probably started ignoring Rayon when she was just a kid, maybe 6 or 7. And as soon as he thought something was different, you know, as soon as he didn't have that little boy that he could take to the ball game or relate to in the way that he expected, I think that he just shut off emotionally and stopped paying attention and really rejected her. So, you know, tough, challenging childhood, among other things. And she's going to say goodbye because she knows she's going to die. But anyway, as far as the clothing, I think of that scene because it's the one and only time in the film that I'm not wearing women's clothing. And it was interesting because I was in character for the entire film, I felt, when I put that suit on, I felt like I was in drag. And that was a really interesting experience and a really intense scene.
I read that you stayed in character through the making of the movie. So I assume what happened is that the other actors, like Matthew McConaughey, become Matthew McConaughey and leave their character when they're not involved in a scene, but that you stayed in the character of Rayon. And how does that help you by not breaking character?
Well, it helps you in a lot of ways. I'll give you a couple examples. When you're on set, most of the time, your experience or your acting, your performance is limited to when the director yells action. We didn't do any rehearsal on this film, which was great, actually. You know, your time creating, experimenting is on camera. When you stay in character, your performance time is unlimited. It's all day long on the set, and it can educate you and give you an opportunity to build the character, in a much better way. I also think that the role was so far removed from who people may expect I am in my daily life that it was really beneficial to stay as close to the part as possible. I couldn't imagine every time the director yelled action to have to recall all of the physicality, all of the stuff going on inside, you know, the voice as well, and the dialect and the walk and the body center, the circumstances on a moment's notice. That would be a much better actor than I am.
Here's what seems it must have been odd. So you're staying in character as a transgendered woman who's living in the 1980s. Everybody else is going back to who they really are in between takes and living in, 2013 or 2012, whenever you actually shot this. So you're not only in character, you're not contemporaneous with the period, and also no one's writing your lines. I mean, you have a script when you're in character, and when you're not actually in a take, you have to write dialogue for this character.
Yeah, and I think that's those are some of the challenges. But I don't think it's about, pretending you're in 1985. I think it's about habit. I think it's about exercise. It's about focus, and it's about concentration. Those are other words that you could substitute for the kind of cliche in character. Some of the physical attributes certainly lead, and really the whole point of them is to lead and connect to your emotional life. And, there are other benefits that come with it as well. I mean, the scene I talked with it about earlier when I wore the suit, it's only because I was so focused all the time on who this person was and staying so close to her that when I finally put that suit on, I still walked like I had the heels on. I still walked like I had my handbag on. I didn't have to figure that out, One day there was a break for a couple of hours and I went to Whole Foods to, stare at the food there because I wasn't eating really. But, and an interesting thing happened. I got three distinct looks. One was, who is that? The other was, what is that? And the third was, I don't know what that is, but I don't like it. And that was a really powerful gaze to get, that condemnation, the judgment, and those sorts of things. Other things happen, like people start treating you different. So it's not about me thinking I'm in 1985 and trying to convince myself that, Reagan is president or whoever was president in 1985. It was really about trying to learn, trying and using it as practice, as rehearsal. Does one of the grips reach out and offer his hand when I'm stepping out of the makeup trailer because he starts to treat me like Rayon? They look at you different. You feel different. I also think that it provided a real sense of truth for Matthew and Jennifer. Such an unbelievably impossible person all of a sudden became believable and possible.
So toward the end of the movie, you are quite emaciated. You're very sick from AIDS. And there's one scene in which your top is off, and you are... I was just shocked at how skeletal you are. I mean, I knew you'd lost weight for the movie, but once your top is off, man, there's only one scene where we see you that way, where we actually see more of your body. You must have had to lose so much weight to get to that point. And I know that for the movie in which you play John Lennon's assassin, Mark David Chapman, you gained about 60 pounds. And I guess I'm wondering, it's such an extreme to go to for the role. Did you worry about sacrificing your health?
Well, I'll put it this way. I would never, ever, ever in a million years gain weight for a film again. It's much more damaging to gain weight than to lose. I mean, I lost between 30 and 40 on Dallas Buyers Club, and I stopped counting because I had lost weight before for a film called Requiem for a Dream.
In which you played a junkie.
Yeah, exactly. But, it's a really challenging thing to do. It's not something that should be treated lightly by anyone. I would never suggest anyone do it, gain or lose. But in this particular case, I was playing a drug addict who was dying of AIDS, and I felt it was important and would also provide a certain amount of fragility to the character. But losing weight is a great tool. It changes the way you walk, the way you talk, the way people treat you, the way you feel about yourself. It changes the choices that you make. So it was an essential element of the character building.
Did you do any permanent damage to your body when you gained or when you lost weight for roles?
I do think that I've damaged myself. I got gout when I gained all of the weight, the 60-something pounds. And at the end of that shoot, I was literally taking a wheelchair to set because I was in so much pain. You know, I couldn't walk down a hallway without hobbling. That was really not a lot of fun. But, you know, once in a lifetime. And fortunately, I remember as well, my cholesterol had shot up so much to, I think, 272 or something. I can't remember the number or what it means exactly, but they wanted to put me on Lipitor after just a couple of months. And I was, a young, really healthy guy before that.
When you gained weight to play Mark David Chapman, Lenin's assassin, and when you lost weight to play Rayon in the Dallas Buyers Club, when you came home and looked at yourself in the mirror, like you take off your makeup, you take off the clothes you're wearing on your set, you're at home, you're about to go to sleep in your own bed, and you look in the mirror, you're no longer yourself. I mean, you physically became the character. It's like you can't take off your body and put your old body back on. So what is it like for you to look in the mirror and you've so transformed yourself that even when you're alone at home in your bedroom, you can't become who you really are?
Well, that's part of the point, I think. Complete and total immersion. To go to a place that is so severe that it compels and pulls the rest of you into the circumstances or situation. But I remember there was a time where I was washing my makeup off in Dallas Buyers Club, and it's like, man, they did a great job. I'm looking real sick. And then you get a hot towel and put it on my face again. And then I wash it again, and I realized that it wasn't the makeup anymore. It was just my face. And that was a bit of a surprise.
My guest is Jared Leto. He co-stars in the new film Dallas Buyers Club. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jared Leto, and he's now one of the stars of the new movie, The Dallas Buyers Club, and he plays a transgendered woman who is very sick with HIV.
I love your show, by the way.
Do you really? Thank you. Well, I love your acting.
Your voice is so relaxing. I mean, I wish I could purchase it and carry it with me.
Wow, I wish I felt that way about my voice.
Oh, it's awesome. It's so focused and clear, and it's like water crystal.
Well, thank you.
Love it.
Thank you. Well, yeah. Well, speaking of voices, you use your voice to great effect in Dallas Buyers Club, and it's a kind of, you're from Dallas in the movie, and it's a southern voice, and you're the kind of person who calls everybody, male and female, sugar. And because you have a very, like, acerbic wit in the movie, you also use your voice to good effect in terms of the kind of digs and sarcastic remarks. On the flip side, you use your voice to great effect as Mark David Chapman, John Lennon's assassin, and he's somebody who was so just like off, just so mentally off. And when he's speaking, like there's no energy or focus in his voice. And I'm wondering if you can compare those two pretty opposite voices for us and tell us about how you got them, and maybe you'd even consider talking that way and demonstrating a little bit, maybe not.
I don't think I could. I would love to demonstrate, but I actually don't think I could. I haven't spoken in either of the voices in quite some time. I remember there was was a pretty drastic shift from my own voice, which is a little bit more monotonous and deeper, probably. They both had a more melody in their voices. They both had a dialect, a southern dialect, and they both were higher in register. And then, you know, I think that it's interesting to talk about voices. I didn't realize this, but I think we got to throw Harry Goldfarb from Requiem into the mix, who had a Brooklyn accent.
That's your character in the movie.
Yeah, yeah, Harry Goldfarb. I think that Harry and Rayon have a lot in common. They're both dreamers. They both have a heart of gold, and they both are trapped by these unbreakable and horrendous circumstances that they happen to be in, and they want for a better life. But voice is really important to me. I don't know why that is. Some actors have, you know, these great gravelly voices, and they just basically need to be who they are every movie, and you're just enamored, and you love to spend time with them. But I don't know, maybe it's identity crisis. But voice was very key for Rayon. And I was born in Louisiana, by the way, so not too far from Texas, and so that melody was very familiar to me.
Jared Leto will be back in the second half of the show. He stars with Matthew McConaughey in the new film Dallas Buyers Club. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Fox Searchlight Pictures with 12 Years a Slave, based on the true story of one man's courage to overcome a decade of injustice, now playing. From Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, boats, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And from Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years, novonordisk-us.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews The Goldfinch, the big new novel by Donna Tartt, a book Maureen says she's been waiting for since first reading David Copperfield. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by Brandi Clark. Ken says every song is worth hearing, and we continue our interview with Jared Leto. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Jared Leto, who co-stars with Matthew McConaughey in the new film Dallas Buyers Club. Leto plays a transgender woman with AIDS in the 1980s. Leto's other films include Requiem for a Dream, Chapter 27, Panic Room, and Fight Club. Dallas Buyers Club is Leto's first film in several years. He took time off from acting to focus on his band 30 Seconds to Mars. Leto got his start almost 20 years ago when he co-starred as a high school student in the TV series My So-Called Life. Here he is in a scene from early in the series. Rumors have been circulating that Angela, played by Claire Danes, and Leto's character, Jordan Catalano, have had sex in his car. when what really happened in the car was an awkward conversation and an even more awkward attempt at a kiss. But she does have a big crush on him. In this scene, Jordan and Angela have run into each other in the stairwell at school.
I didn't say anything about, you know.
I know.
I just wanted you to know that.
Thank you.
Because I'm not like that. I don't do that.
No.
So weird, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, the way people talk. I mean, people think we did it.
I know.
It's like I might as well have done it anyway at this point.
Oh.
I mean, at least, you know, I mean, if everybody's talking about it already, maybe we, I mean, not to make a big deal of it or anything.
Out of what?
Out of anything. I mean, if everybody's already assuming it anyway, maybe we should just...
It's amazing the things you notice. Like the corner of his collar that was coming undone. Like he was from a poor family and couldn't afford new shirts. That's all I could see. The whole world was that unraveled piece of fabric.
I think I have to go.
Look, I'm sorry if I...
No, it's okay.
No pressure or anything.
I have to go.
You could just think about it.
A lot of people got introduced to you through the series My So-Called Life, which starred Claire Danes as a high school age girl who has a really big crush on your character, Jordan Catalano. And I'm wondering about how that Jordan, the character of Jordan, who's a kind of like not very talkative, not the most like book intelligent person, but charismatic, how his character compared to who you were in high school.
Oh God, not comparable at all. So different, you know. I barely made it through high school. I actually dropped out in the 10th grade.
Did you go back to high school?
I did end up going back to the type of school that you can cram in a couple years in one. The one that all the questionable kids or other people that may have challenging situations, you know. But it was a decent place. And then I went on to study to be an artist, a painter. And I went to three different art colleges. And, you know, I always wanted to be an artist. It was either an artist or a drug dealer. I thought those two had a lot of promise.
What was your childhood like? I read that you grew up for, I think, a couple of years in a commune.
I moved around a lot. We were vagabonds. I've said this before as kind of a joke, but there's a lot of truth to it, as my mother climbed out of the muddy banks in the Mississippi with her kids in one hand and food stamps in the other, barely 18, and an attempt to make a better life for herself. You know, that's basically was the beginning.
So she was a single mother?
Yeah.
Did you know your father?
I did not.
And still don't?
No.
So what did she do to support the family?
What did she do, or what did she do? She put herself through college. She educated herself, and you know that's the wonderful thing when the system does work. I believe she had to leave Louisiana in order to do that, and headed up towards other places where she could get some assistance. That's a good thing when it works like that.
So forgive me for keeping asking you about the commune, but I'm just always so curious what it's like for kids who grew up in a commune, what it was like from their perspective.
Well, there was time in a circus as well, and there were a lot of similarities. It's a group of people that are kind of on the fringes that want to either escape or find something. And they join this community in hopes that they will achieve one or the other.
So you spent some time in a circus?
Yeah.
What was your mother doing in the circus?
Trapeze.
Seriously? I can't tell if you're pulling my leg.
No, I mean, there are more unbelievable things to do in the world, trust me. But it, had she, if she was, we could, we, if she was, you know, if she was here right now, she would probably talk about being a photographer, an artist, a mom, a nurse, and a creative person. And I think the thing that my mother taught us most was that we should pursue our creative ambitions, which was totally normal to us as kids to hear, like your mom say, "Yeah, be an artist, do something creative, be, do what you're excited about doing." It's not until I got much older that I realized that's a pretty unique thing and a pretty brave thing when you think about how challenging that life can be. You know, it's certainly not a safe route to take. You know, very few visual artists and creative people have the pleasure to make a living from the thing that they love the most. So that was pretty cool. I was thinking about that just this morning.
So I got a circusy question for you. In
In
your music video, Up in the Air, which won a VMA award.
Yeah.
There's a lot of images in it. One of them is of somebody who might have been the, quote, fat lady in a circus. I mean, she's very heavy, and she's nearly naked in the shot. Is she, background about that? What's that
She
about?
Is beautifully overweight, and it's actually my mom.
That's your mom?
I'm just kidding.
I can't trust you.
You called my mom fat.
No, I see. Now we have to go through the whole. I have to come through the whole interview and ask myself.
Yeah, well, you know, if we don't keep it off balance a little bit, it's never going to be interesting.
Yeah, I know.
The circus thing. I've always been, obviously, enamored by the circus. You know, I mean, you know, my real father could have been a clown. You never know these things.
So here's a question for you. Was your mother really a trapeze artist?
Well, I can't confirm or deny anything about my mother because, you know, who knows? I mean, we could have eaten
the answer
magic
is that
mushrooms.
You know. You know.
The things that were floating
you're not
around
saying, okay.
In that teepee.
I'm taking
I mean,
that as a
God.
No. I'm taking that
once
as
in a...
a
while, once in a while, my brother would eat the wrong brownies. And, I mean, the thing that we would see.
Okay. I hear you. That's a no.
I wouldn't say so, but if it's all right, it's all right. We'll see who believes and who doesn't.
How did you get your foot in the door in acting, and why did you want to do it?
Well, I didn't want to do it. I actually didn't want to be an actor. I wanted to be an artist, and I think that's still the case. I had a plan when I was in art school. I was studying filmmaking at that time. Kind of like non-traditional, non-narrative art film, video art, but I wanted to make more narrative films. So I thought, wow, you know what? I bet if I get a job as an actor, that'll help me get a job as a director. And that was actually my plan. That was my goal. But I kind of had a secret desire to create characters, to tell stories in front of the camera as well.
Now that you've ended your 5-year hiatus from acting with the new film, The Dallas Buyers Club, are you going to act again? Are you going to stay in it again?
Well, it was an incredible experience, the role of a lifetime, the support and love around the performance in the film is absolutely astounding. I'm in shock. Ever since Toronto Film Festival, it's just been, I've been in a daze. So I have a lot of gratitude for that. I haven't read another script since. I read the script for this film. But I would love to find something really special. You know, the special ones just don't come around very often.
Right.
So I don't know.
Well, I hope I can look forward to seeing more of you on screen.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you. My God, this was the quickest interview ever. I can't believe it. It's already gone.
Jared Leto co-stars in the new film Dallas Buyers Club. Leto also directed a video that was released this week for this song, City of Angels, by his band 30 Seconds to Mars. His brother Shannon is also in the band.
There was truth, there was consequence against you. A weak defense, then there's me. I'm 17, looking for a fight. All my life, I was never there.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new album from country singer-songwriter Brandi Clark. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Brandi Clark's debut album called 12 Stories. Clark is a singer-songwriter from Washington State who in recent years has made an impact in Nashville as a songwriter. She's written or co-written hits for acts as various as Miranda Lambert, the band Perry, and Kacey Musgraves.
We live in trailers and apartments too, from California to Kalamazoo. Grow up, get married, and when that one ends, we hate sleeping alone, so we get married again. Don't want to be buried in debt or in sin, so we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto.
That's Pray to Jesus, the song that leads off 12 Stories, Brandi Clark's modestly amazing album. Pray to Jesus isn't a conventionally religious song. It sets up what will be a recurring theme throughout this collection, a quick, precise sketch of specific people, mostly rural, many of them working class, who don't see a heck of a lot going right in their lives, now or in the foreseeable future. So, as Clark sings, we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto because there ain't but two ways we can change tomorrow. Clark is working in a time-honored tradition, yet managing to articulate it in a fresh way.
I know I shouldn't be here tonight. I hardly know this man. It's been a long time since I felt as pretty as he tells me I. I've met him at the coffee shop, and I've met him in the park, but I've never been alone with him in this dress after dark. There's so many shades.
That lovely melody and astringent twang vocal are in the service of a slightly sordid scenario. A married woman having an affair with a married man, or as Clark phrases it, he's some stranger's husband, I'm some stranger's wife. The clever clincher is the chorus couplet, "What'll keep me out of heaven will take me there tonight." That Jesus she was praying to in the first song is now the God condemning adultery, but the narrator just can't help herself. This willingness to sing in the persona of someone we might not necessarily like is at once Clark's signal claim to adventurousness and what's probably going to keep her album from climbing very high on the country charts.
Mama got depressed when Daddy was a-dying, so the doctor gave her something to help her with her crying. Then she couldn't sleep, so he gave her something else. Now there's yellow, red, and pink on her bathroom shelf. Says if one won't work, then another one will. If you got a little hurt, you take a little pill.
Clark is working in a tradition that hops back a few decades. She comes out of the era of 1980s country women such as Reba McEntire, the Judds, K.T. Oslin, Pam Tillis, and Roseanne Cash before country got too confining for her. These were among the most full-throated women staking a claim for progressive freedoms within the confines of country's intrinsically conservative social scenarios. These days, at a time when some of the biggest male country stars are literally singing the praises of women's rear ends and the joys of nonstop tailgate parties, someone like Brandi Clark comes across like a terse realist novelist, landing somewhere between Sarah Orne Jewett and Mary Gateskill. For example, one theme that runs through 12 stories is that alcohol may help you unwind, but it also helps things fall apart.
I did the laundry, I cleaned the kitchen, swept up the pieces of those broken dishes. I drank my coffee while yours got colder, all while you were hungover. I put on lipstick, I planted roses, painted the bathroom that you never noticed. I felt the first chill of October, all while you were hungover. Baby, your head ain't the only thing hurting, you know. The sun keeps coming up even if the curtains are closed.
12 Stories is one of those rare albums whose every song is worth hearing. Every one is that striking, that textured, and finely detailed. It is my fervent hope that Clark, who's helped other women achieve hit singles, will have her own hits from among these smoothly crafted, emotionally rough compositions.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed 12 Stories by Brandi Clark. You can see a video of her song Pray to Jesus on our website. That's freshair.npr.org.
She's getting hammered on Alabama slammers. Three drinks ago, no, he wouldn't stand a chance. He's sipping whiskey, feeling confident and frisky. Right slow hand on a 20 and slips it to the band. By the end of the first verse, they're out on the floor. By the end of the song, they're out the door. Spirits are up, inhibitions are down. Same stories unfolding all over town.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Donna Tartt's new novel, The Goldfinch. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Donna Tartt is a novelist who won't be hurried. Starting with her debut novel, The Secret History, which came out in 1992, she seems to be establishing a pattern of publishing one novel a decade. Tartt's third novel, The Goldfinch, has just appeared, and our book critic Maureen Corrigan says that she would gladly wait another decade, if she had to, for a novel this good.
Dickensian is one of those literary modifiers that's overused. But before I officially retire this ruined adjective, or exile it to Australia, as Dickens himself would have done, I want to give it one final outing, because no other word will do. Here goes. Donna Tartt's grand new novel, The Goldfinch, is Dickensian, both in the ambition of its jumbo, coincidence-laced plot, as well as in its symphonic range of emotions. The Goldfinch far exceeds the expectations of those of us who've been waiting on Tartt to do something extraordinary again ever since her debut novel, The Secret History, came out in 1992. Hell, I feel like I've been waiting for a novel like this to appear not only since I read The Secret History, but since I first read David Copperfield. There's a lot of Copperfield in Tartt's hero, Theo Decker, who's 13 years old at the start of this story, which he narrates in retrospect as an adult. Young Theo lives with his adored, beautiful mother in Manhattan. His dad, a shiftless actor and gambler, has deserted them, and good riddance, too. Unfortunately, Theo is not as pure as David Copperfield was as a boy. In fact, on the most fateful morning of his life, Theo and his mother have an appointment at his prep school to discuss his suspension for smoking on the school grounds. Or maybe it's for stealing. Theo is guilty of that crime, too. But what Theo will ultimately spend the rest of his life atoning for is the death of his mother. It wasn't his fault. Adults will assure him it was a terrible accident, rotten luck, could have happened to anyone. It's all perfectly true, Theo admits, and I don't believe a word of it. What happens is that on the way to the school appointment, Theo and his mom take shelter from a sudden thunderstorm by ducking into the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Theo's mom studied art, and she steers him over to one of her most beloved paintings. It's called The Goldfinch, and it's an actual painting done in the mid-17th century by a teacher of Vermeer's named Carol Fabricius. Theo half listens to his mother's lecture on the glories of this painting of an alert yellow bird chained to a perch by its twig of an ankle. Then, just as they're moving off to the dreaded school appointment, a terrorist bomb explodes in the Met. Theo's mother is killed, and life as he knew it is shattered. As in The Secret History and her second, less successful novel, The Little Friend, which centered on an unsolved murder, Tartt plays here with the conventions of the suspense thriller. In the aftermath of the explosion, Theo comforts a dying man who gives him a ring and points to the small painting of the goldfinch lying in the rubble out of its frame. Theo takes custody of both objects, and they lead him on a Baroque coming-of-age adventure that includes a season in hell in Las Vegas with his deadbeat dad, brushes with the Russian mob, unrequited love, excessive teen drug use, and the discovery of a place almost like home in a New York antique shop, an old curiosity shop, if you will, run by an open-hearted mensch named Hobie, who becomes Theo's guardian. I have, by the way, only taken us halfway through this 700-plus page novel. As ingenious as Tartt's plot is, this novel would be but a massive scaffolding feat were it not for her uncanny way with words. Here's Theo, as an adult, telling us about a feverish dream he had of his mother. She came up suddenly beside me, so I saw her reflection in a mirror. At the sight of her, I was paralyzed with happiness. She was smiling at me, not a dream, but a presence that filled the whole room. I knew I couldn't turn around, that to look at her directly was to violate the laws of her world and mine. Our eyes met in the glass for a long moment, but just as she seemed about to speak, a vapor rolled between us, and I woke up. Like the goldfinch in the painting he can't bring himself to relinquish, Theo is chained, forever yearning for the mother he lost on that terrible day in the museum. His loneliness is the realistic emotional constant in this crowded, exuberantly plotted triumph of a novel. And if that ain't Dickensian, I don't know what is.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Charlie Kyer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our assistant producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from DK with DK Eyewitness Travel Guides, celebrating 20 years of publishing guidebooks to more than 200 destinations, online and in stores now. From Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. And from Lumosity.com, with web-based brain games created by neuroscientists to improve memory and attention. Learn more at Lumosity.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with Hollywood stuntman Hal Needham. He died last week at the age of 82 after a career of death-defying stunts. He doubled for John Wayne and Burt Reynolds and directed Smokey and the Bandit and Cannonball Run. Join us.